Okay, we're going to continue our study in the book of Revelation this morning. We're moving on to chapter 14. Chapter 14 now. And do we have sound? Are we okay on the sound back there? Okay. Well, let's go ahead and just continue on then. Let's see. Revelation chapter number 14. Notice, Revelation chapter 14 is really a continuation of the thinking that's going on in chapter 13, but it's all going to be contrast. It's real interesting. You'll notice in chapter 14, verse 1 starts with the word "and." So it's not a new and a different, it's a continuation, but it's going to be complete contrast with everything that you saw in chapter 13. I trust you will recall that in chapter number 13, what did we say? You had what? The unholy trinity, right? You have the dragon, you've got the beast who is the Antichrist, and the beast who is the false prophet. And they have put forward their command for everybody to worship the image of the beast, and if they don't worship the image of the beast, what do they get? They lose the vital part of their anatomy called their head, okay? So now, when you get to chapter 14, you don't want to make a break in the progression here. Chapter 14, verse 1 says this, "And I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on the Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 having his father's name written in their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven as the voice of many waters, and as the voice of a great thunder, and I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps. And they sung as it were a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders. And no man could learn that song but the 144,000 which were redeemed from the earth. These are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne." Okay, so verses 1 through 5 here, verses 1 through 5. In chapter 14, verses 1 through 5, you've got the scene, and that's clearly in heaven. And specifically on Mount Zion. The New Testament is Zion. Okay? And you see the Lord Jesus Christ with the 144,000. Okay? Now who remembers where we saw these 144,000 prior to this? Remember what chapter it was in Revelation? Go to chapter number 7. Go to chapter number 7 is where they're sealed. See chapter 7, verse 1. "After these things I saw four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, nor on the sea, nor on any tree. And I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God, and he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was given to hurt the earth and the sea, saying, Hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads. And I heard the number of them which were sealed, and there were sealed 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel," and so on. In chapter number 7, the scene is the angel is going to come down and seal them on the earth. In chapter number 14, you now see these 144,000, and they are in heaven on Mount Zion. Obviously, they have been transported there. There's been a catching up. There's been... they've been removed from the earth here in chapter 14. Now, a couple of things about these individuals. It's rather significant. Remember I mentioned just a moment ago that chapter 14, since it starts with the word "and," that you want to make the connection with chapter 13, but you're going to see all is contrast. Okay? Just lots of contrast to these things. Did you have a question? Or?
Is Zion and Zion different?
Yes. Zion is how it's spelled in the Old Testament. Zion is how it's spelled in the New Testament. It's the same place. What's that?
Are they both talking about heaven?
Well, now, there is... let me say it this way. On earth, there is a Jerusalem on earth, and right by Jerusalem is Mount Zion on the earth, or Mount Zion. And then there's the heavenly Jerusalem, and then there's a heavenly Mount Zion. This is the one in heaven. Okay? All right. Now, remember I mentioned that it's all contrast here. Look over to chapter 14, verse 1 again. It says, "And I looked, and lo, a lamb." Did we see a lamb in chapter 13? Did we see a lamb in chapter 13? We sure did. Look at chapter 13, verse 11. It says, "And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a..." Interesting. You compare chapter 13 and chapter 14, and everything is contrast. You've got a lamb on the earth. It says two horns like a lamb. Now, what typically is a lamb? Is a lamb an older or a younger of the gender, of the species? It's the younger. So this guy's got two little horns, the guy in chapter 13. All right. Over in chapter 14, you see another lamb. Obviously, this lamb is up in Mount Zion, and he's with the 144,000 there. Isn't that interesting? And I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on the Mount Zion with him, and 144,000 having their father's name written in their foreheads. Now, you should notice another contrast there. Where was the mark of the beast supposed to be? In their foreheads. And so you begin to put the contrast, right? You can see it, verse 2, "And I heard a voice from heaven as the voice of many waters and the voice of a great thunder." That, both of those ideas are from the Old Testament. Several passages that talk about when you're in the throne room of God, those are the kinds of things that you hear. So it's obvious that you're in the presence of God. "And I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps, and they sung as it were a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders." See that? So they're up in Mount Zion, and God is there, His throne is there, the four beasts are there that you saw in chapter 4, and the 24 elders are there, and these 144,000, they're singing a new song. Now, it's interesting that in the book of Revelation, and not just in the book of Revelation, but in the book of Revelation, a couple of times you're going to see the idea of a new song. And in the Old Testament, a lot of times, we're not going to look at all the references and everything, because it's not our purpose to go verse by verse, per se, we're just hitting some highlights. But sometimes, if you want just a fascinating study, get your concordance out and look up the reference, new song, and go look at all of them. It's amazing how many there are in the Old Testament that really speak prophetically about the kingdom and the eternal reign of Christ and so forth. At any rate, there are some things that's kind of interesting about this new song, and what is it? Look at verse 3. "They sung as it were a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders, and no man could learn that song but the 144,000 which were redeemed from the earth." What's kind of interesting about this new song? Right, it's not for everybody. And who said what? Yeah, only they could sing it. No man is able to learn this song except these 144,000. Now, what's that mean? Does that mean there's going to be no learning in heaven? Does that mean there's going to be no education in heaven? No. What does that mean that no man's able to learn this song? Who is it that... Remember, we have a song around here sometimes that we sing that there's a song that holy angels cannot sing. "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound." Remember? How come the angels can't sing a song that says, "Saved a wretch like me"? Exactly. Angels, there is no justification for angels. Okay? So when it says here about these 144,000 that they sung a song which no man is able to learn except them, it's because they're the ones that it applies to, and evidently nobody else. Now sometimes the idea comes forth from this passage, therefore, that there's only going to be 144,000 people saved in heaven. Got some sound back there. Anyway, sometimes from this passage comes the suggestion that only 144,000 people are actually going to wind up in heaven because they're the only ones that can sing this song. And you understand that's not the case at all. We've seen already a couple of times in the book of Revelation where there's going to be multitudes saved in the kingdom prophetic program beyond the 144,000. So you don't want to take this passage to suggest the idea that there's only going to be 144,000 out of Israel saved totally. That's not the point of this. These 144,000, and then there's going to be another group he makes reference to that die from this point forward in the tribulation period. They're very unique in history. And it's because they're confronted with the mark of the beast, and they reject it. See, nobody else prior to this point has been confronted with the mark of the beast, right? You haven't. Daniel back in the Old Testament wasn't. Peter, James, John, they weren't confronted with the mark of the beast. These guys are going to be. All right? So it's unique to their particular situation in that tribulation period.
In verse 2 there, which is, I heard a voice from heaven.
Yeah. No, it's like this. You're hearing a voice from where?
Earth.
Right now, where are you hearing a voice from? You're on earth hearing a voice from earth. You're in this building hearing a voice from this building. Yeah. Okay. All right, so look at verse 3. And they sung as it were a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders, and no man could learn that song but the 144,000 which were redeemed from the earth. Which again, by the way, the little phrase redeemed from the earth tells you that the focus, as far as what Revelation is about, is redemption of and from the earth. Okay? These are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. And we didn't read it, but if you go back to chapter 7, it demonstrates that same issue. All right? Now, if you look at verse 4 again, these are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. Understand this, that certainly there is the idea that participation... We've got a demon out there. Okay. You know, squawking at us. Anyway, in Israel's program, any time that you're involved with the lie program in the Bible, that's likened unto spiritual adultery, right? Anytime you're part of the lie program, that's likened unto spiritual adultery. And certainly, I think he stirred them all up out there. But better make sure he comes back alive. Hey, we're praying for you, Steve. but those ravens in the Gospels, right? So we prayed for you, brother. Yeah, really. Okay. So in the prophetic program, anytime that you're involved with the lie, it's likened unto spiritual adultery, spiritual fornication. And you're going to see that in chapter 17 and 18 of Revelation. But that's pretty common, all right? Because that is the case, it is often suggested that in this passage that these 144,000, when it said these were not defiled with women, for they are virgins, that it doesn't mean that none of them were married or that type of thing, but it simply means that they were not involved in the satanic program. All right? Hold on just a second. And then I'll get a question. Understand this. Absolutely, it is absolutely clear that these guys were not involved with the satanic program. There's no doubt about that part. Okay? There's no doubt that they refused the mark of the beast. They were sealed with the seal of God and so forth. They do not participate at all in the lie program. But when it says here that these guys... If it was simply saying that they did not partake of the wine of the fornication of the Antichrist and so forth, why give us the added details? It says, these are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. That's a true statement. That is a statement of fact about these individuals. Understand this, that the lie program, Satan's abominable program in the tribulation period, is going to be, as far as God's concerned, the actual program itself, fornication, it's going to be adultery and so forth. But you got to understand something as well, that Satan is actually going to use the physical fleshly appetites to draw people in. These guys, what's that? Yeah, okay. But understand, these guys are going to totally stay away from that. All right. Now, Mike, you got a question or comment? Let me think about that. Yeah, there probably is. Yeah, let me think about that. Look with me. I recently was rereading the book of Proverbs and so forth, and I'm going to get off track just a moment here, and then I'm going to come back to it. But go over to the book of Proverbs here. I mentioned before that, you know, God didn't write His Word, His Scripture, for the purpose of it being a book of, quote-unquote, just devotions, a religious book. This isn't a religious book, okay? And a lot of times when people approach Psalms or approach Proverbs and everything, they view it more as a devotional book. They'll go back and they'll look at a verse or two, and then they'll think about, okay, Lord, how can I apply this to my life? That's what I mean by devotions and everything. But God didn't write His Word for that purpose. He doesn't write His Word for the purpose of us becoming more religious. You know what I mean? That's not what He's doing. In the book of Proverbs, I'm going to read this passage here, and I want you to think about this passage in connection with the temptation, the satanic draw to entice somebody to be part of the lie program. And in the passage here, it is, well, you'll see it. Look over to Proverbs chapter 5 here. Proverbs chapter 5, verse 1. Proverbs chapter 5, verse 1. My son, attend unto my wisdom, and bow thine ear to my understanding, that thou mayest regard discretion, and that thy lips may keep knowledge. What I'm going to read here, it is a true statement. It is a fact that the instructions here can help a young man, help any man for that matter, not get involved in adultery and fornication. What I'm saying is that that's not the primary purpose of this passage. You'll see something else. Look at what he says here. He says, verse 3, for the lips of a strange woman drop as in honeycomb, and her mouth is smoother than oil, but her end is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death, her steps take hold on hell. Lest thou shouldest ponder the path of life, her ways are movable that thou canst not know them. Hear me now, therefore, O ye children, and depart not from the words of my mouth. Remove thy way far from her, and come not nigh the door of her house, lest thou give thine honor unto others, and thy years unto the cruel. Lest strangers be filled with thy wealth, and thy labor be in the house of a stranger. And so on. You see the comparison here? That he's likening the enticement of what he calls here a strange woman. He's likening the enticement of a woman to entice a man to come in unto her to the parallel with the lie program enticing Israel to go and be part of that lie program and hence be involved in spiritual fornication and adultery. Now, the enticement of a woman to a man, to adultery, fornication, and the spiritual enticement, both are true, real temptations. You understand what I'm saying? And you're going to see this pattern actually comes up several times in the book of Proverbs. We don't really need to get all in detail and so forth. Let's see here. Go to chapter 7. Look at verse 6. For at the window of my house I looked through my casement, and behold, among the simple ones I discerned among the youths a young man void of understanding. Here's a guy that doesn't understand what's going on, all right? Not only really just in the sense of the human flesh, but in the sense of the satanic lie program, all right? And so what happens is this. It says at verse 8, passing through the street near her corner, and he went the way to her house. In the twilight in the evening, in the black and dark night, and behold, there met him a woman with the attire of an harlot and subtle of heart. She is loud and stubborn. Her feet abide not in her house. Now is she without, now in the street, and lieth in wait at every corner. So she caught him and kissed him, and with an impudent face said unto him, I have peace offerings with me. This day have I paid my vows. Therefore came I forth to meet thee, diligently to seek, and so on and so forth. She got herself all dressed, etc., that type of thing. What I'm saying is this. You read the book of Proverbs, it's clear that there is real practical instruction in these chapters for men not to be seduced, not to be enticed by women, etc., that type of thing. But what I'm saying is that that's not the primary purpose for which the Proverbs was written. There is a spiritual enticement to participate in the spiritual fornication and adultery of the lie program. When you're in the book of Revelation, therefore, and by the way, you know that many, many times God accused Israel of fornication and adultery, right? That's the whole concept there. In the book of Revelation, they are going to be enticed by this beautiful, gorgeous, sexy woman that's just, spiritually all speaking, that's enticing them to come in and participate in that false apostate system of the Antichrist. These 144,000, guess what? They're not going to do it. Why? Because of sound doctrine. If you look at Revelation chapter number 14, verse 4, these are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. That is not only a statement of their physical situation, you know, physical carnal situation, fleshly situation, but it is a statement also of their spiritual condition. Okay? All right, let's move on. So it says, these are they which follow the Lamb. You know the old children's rhyme. Mary had a little lamb. And I forget the rhyme. How's it go? The lamb doesn't follow Mary. These guys follow the lamb. Okay, anyway. These are they which follow the lamb with us wherever he goeth. Remember the Lord said, follow me. Follow me. Okay. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits, which means there's more coming, unto God and to the Lamb. In their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. The idea of no guile is their sins have been totally, completely forgiven. An Israelite indeed in whom is no guile. David talked about no guile. It's somebody who's total forgiveness. Okay? Let's move on now. So you got a scene in heaven at verses 1 through 5. And then from verse 6, really to the end of the chapter, you're going to have three or four different scenes that happen here on the earth. I'm sorry, in heaven and then on the earth. And in heaven and then on the earth. It's fascinating. And you're going to have six different angels that come out and they start saying some things. Just as an example, look at verse 6. And I saw, what's it say there? Another angel flying in the midst of heaven. Jump ahead to verse 8. And there followed, what? Another angel. Now verse 9. And the third angel followed. Now go to verse 15. And another angel came out. Verse 17. And another angel came out. And then verse 18. And another angel came out. You've got six angels that appear. And right in the middle of them you have the Lord appearing. Okay? So let's kind of work our way down through here. What's going to happen with the appearance of these angels? The rest of chapter 14 is almost like it's prophetic of what's yet to come. It's like the consequences. If you'll remember where you are when you're in chapter 12, you're at the middle of the tribulation period. We've tried to convey this several times. If that represents the 70th week of Daniel, the 7-year period, when you're at chapter number 12, you're at the middle of the tribulation period. All right. And then, the mark of the beast is being enforced from that point forward. These angels start to appear, the everlasting gospel. You're going out to the end of that thing. And then as you get to chapter number 15, you're going to have the seven last plagues. So you're like down to literally the last few months of this thing. But when you're in chapter 14, you're given some glimpses and some pictures of the consequences of what happens from this point forward. Okay? Watch it happen. Look over to chapter 14, verse 6. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having, what's it say here? The everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, and to every nation and kindred and tongue and people. So what happens is this angel is released, and this angel, now you realize when you draw an angel, what you're not supposed to draw him with what?
No wings.
No wings and? No long hair. You don't make him look like a woman, right? A woman with wings, right? Because angels are men. Anyway, so you've got this guy flying through heaven and so forth, which is going to be kind of startling. You've got a guy flying through heaven out there, right? No wings and all that kind of stuff. And he's going to be preaching the everlasting gospel. Think about the content of this gospel. This is very significant. Verse 7. Saying with a loud voice. Now you thought your kids were loud, right? This guy flies through heaven and the whole world can hear this thing, saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to Him, for the hour of His judgment is come, and worship Him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters. Several things to appreciate about this. Notice the timing. It says, for the hour of His judgment is come. Now what's the difference between, just when we talk about a day and an hour, what's the difference between those two? A day is what? Is it bigger or smaller than an hour? Right, exactly. See that? You talk about a day, you've got, say, 24 hours. If you talk about an hour, obviously you've narrowed it down. The fact that you're told here that the angel is saying that the hour of his judgment has come tells you this angel is not released out here at the beginning of this thing. Right? You're way down towards the end of this thing. You're past the mark of the beast as far as when the angel is dispatched. He's out there, and it's like that last, in fact, that is what it is. The last, final, great news of God that's good is called the everlasting gospel. And this angel is dismissed right out here towards, just when I say, I should say released, right out here towards the end of this thing. Alright? And it's the angel, the release of this angel is set against the backdrop of the offer of the false prophet. What's the offer of the false prophet? Who remembers? Or else what? You make it, he commands the world to make an image, he gives life to the image, and then he commands the world to worship the image of the beast. And then what's his offer? If you want to live and you want to eat, then just take the mark of the beast. I got good news for you. You want to live and eat? You want to be healthy, wealthy, and wise? Take the mark of the beast. And if you don't take them, right? That's the offer of the false prophet. Well, what does this angel say? This angel says, no, you better fear God and give glory to Him. See that? Look at that verse again, verse 7. Fear God and give glory to Him, for the hour of His judgment has come, and worship not the beast, but who? Chapter 14, 7 there. Worship Him. Now notice the qualifying, why should they worship Him? What does it go on to say here? So what's the basis upon which they should worship the one that the angel says to worship? After all, why should they believe the angel? They got a guy on earth that's calling fire out of heaven. They got a guy on earth doing all these miracles and signs and wonders. Well, why should I listen to that guy flying through heaven? That's not necessarily one more powerful than the other. See the difference here? Yeah. The guy on the earth, he makes this image. He gives life to the image, causes it to speak, and then in heaven you've got this angel saying, no, that's not the one to worship. You see the great battles going to be going on here? You talk about Star Wars. The heart of the everlasting gospel, let me ask it this way. What is the heart of the gospel of the grace of God? What do you have to say, what do you have to communicate in order to have communicated the gospel of the grace of God? Christ died for your sins, was buried, and rose again. If you don't say that, you have not said the gospel of the grace of God. What if you say this? Repent and be baptized. What gospel are you saying? Gospel of the kingdom. What is this gospel? This is called the everlasting gospel. What's the content of this gospel? Fear God and give Him the glory. Worship Him. Him. For what reason? Because He is the what? The Creator. And He's fixing to come back to judge His creation. There's no blood in this gospel. You see that? Everybody see that in the verse? It's a fascinating issue, because a lot of times you hear people say, well, there's just one gospel throughout the whole Bible. Well, you know, that just isn't true. Right here alone. The content of the everlasting gospel is not the blood of Christ. It's not Christ died for your sins, buried, and rose again. It's not even if you bless Abraham, God will bless you. That isn't the gospel here. This gospel here is fear God and give glory to Him. He's the Creator, and He's fixing to come and judge and take back His creation. Did you have a question or comment? Okay, gotcha. Yeah, very interesting. Yeah.
That's what I was told. Yeah. Would
cover those who we miss. Yeah, yeah. Well, while that may be, while the concept might be true, that's not why this is happening here. But literally what happens, the reason that God dispatches this angel is because the hour of His judgment has come. This is like that last great final call that God sends to the world and says, guys, here it is. You're either going to worship Him that is the Creator, or you're going to worship Him that's just an idol. See that? Now, this is real instructive for a number of reasons. Have you ever thought about, a lot of times in our studies, we contrast and compare the dispensation of the law with the dispensation of grace, right? And we'll compare the gospel of the kingdom with the gospel of the grace of God. We'll even go back as far as to Abraham with the good news promised to Abraham, that back there, if you were a Gentile, then the way to be saved was to bless Abraham and his seed. But have you ever wondered, what was the gospel before ever there was an Abraham? I mean, you had human life on this planet from Adam until Moses. It was about 2,500 years, some of the 2,500 years. That's potentially a lot of people, a lot of souls. So what was the gospel back there? What was the gospel before there ever was the written word of God? That's exactly what it was. That's why this is here now. Because what man fundamentally knew and was accountable for, and Romans chapter 1 teaches this very clearly, the fundamental issue that all men know, even though they deny it, they reject it, they're taught against it, is, you know what? God created all things. He's the one you're accountable for. All right? That's why it comes up here. When you're here this late in the tribulation period, this late in human history, the hour of His judgment has come. It's as though God brings right back to the very beginning to mankind that the issue is God is the Creator. He's worthy of our worship. See that? That's why this angel is dispatched out. One of the reasons why the angel is dispatched out here. Okay, so there's a whole lot of other issues about that, but I want to move on. So now watch this. Look at the next angel. So this angel is released with the everlasting gospel. If you're right down towards the end of that thing. If they feared God and worshipped Him, what would they therefore reject? That's right. They'd reject the Antichrist and hence the mark of the beast. Okay, so now watch what happens, verse 8. And there follows another angel saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. So now you have this second angel that is released out here, okay? And the second angel goes out there with a great prophetic announcement that Babylon is fallen. And you're going to get the details of that in chapter 17 and 18. So next to that verse, you need to write down Revelation chapter 17 and 18. Revelation 17 and 18. You also should write down Jeremiah 51 and Jeremiah chapter 50, Jeremiah 51, and so forth. But what happens is this. Since the hour of His judgment has come, then this angel is released without that prophetic pronouncement that Babylon is fallen. So that's what you see happening in that verse right there. We'll get the details of that when we get to chapter 17 and 18. Alright? Now look at the next angel. This third angel is sent forth. Verse 9. And the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice. If any man worship the beast and his image, and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascendeth up forever and ever, and they have no rest day nor night who worship the beast and his image and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name. We'll read the next couple of verses in just a moment. Remember I said that in chapter 14 you have so many contrasts with chapter 13. What is the offer in chapter 13? What's the offer from the person who's in control on the earth in chapter 13? What's that? Life if you do what? if you worship the beast. But it's a false offer. See that? And it is said in complete contrast. The reason that this third angel is released at this point, remember, chapter 13, you've got the offer. It may not be the best way to say it, but frankly, it is what it is. The false prophet and the Antichrist are going to control the economic scene of the world and so forth. And their offer is, if you want to participate, if you want to eat, if you want to live, then you got to take the mark of the beast and so forth. All right? So it's either physical life or lose your head. That's chapter 13. This angel now is released, and this angel tells them the consequences from God's perspective of what? Of taking the mark of the beast. Right? What are the consequences? The same shall drink of the wine of the wrath which is poured out without mixture in the cup of his indignation, and he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb, and the smoke of their torment shall ascend up forever and ever, and they have no rest day nor night who worship the beast in his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name. So you have these great competing messages. Think about what all is going on here. You've got the false prophet on earth with all these signs. You've got this angel flying through heaven with the everlasting gospel. You've got another angel flying through heaven saying Babylon is fallen, the great city that everybody was trusting in and having confidence in. He's pronouncing it's fallen. And then you've got this other angel that's going out there saying, if you take the mark of the beast, here's your result. Here's what you're going to get. I mean, what are you to do? You see, they have a decision to make, don't they? The Antichrist is saying, take the mark of the beast and live. God is saying, take the mark of the beast and die eternally. The Antichrist is saying, if you don't take the mark of the beast, you lose your head. God says, if you don't take the mark of the beast, now go start at verse 12. Here is the patience of the who? Saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God, the faith of Jesus. These are the guys that don't take the mark of the beast. Watch verse 13. And I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, write, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth. From whenceforth? From the point of the mark of the beast forward. See that? Blessed are those guys. The Antichrist said, no, they're not going to be blessed. They're going to lose their head. They're going to die. But God says, through this angel, he says, if you take the mark of the beast, you die the second death. But if you refuse the mark of the beast, God says, blessed are the dead that die from this point forward. Look at what it says here. Yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, and their works do follow them. See that? Isn't that incredible? The great contrast here. The Antichrist is saying, you take the mark of the beast and you live. God's angel says, you take the mark of the beast and you die the eternal death. The Antichrist is saying, you refuse the mark of the beast and you'll lose your head. God says, blessed are they that die from this point forward, because the reason that they die is because they're refusing the mark of the beast. They're keeping the commandments of the Lord. They're following Him, and they're going to be able to rest from their labors, and they're going to enter into that kingdom. Isn't that fascinating? So you see how chapter 13 is followed right by chapter 14. At the end of chapter 13, it looks as though, and at the time it's going to appear this way, that the Antichrist, that the unholy Trinity, the beast, the false prophet, and Satan have got total, complete control of all that's going on. And then these angels go out. The first guy goes out and says, wait a minute, here's some good news right at the end of this thing. You still got a chance to make a decision out here. Next guy goes out and says, hey, Babylon is fallen, is fallen. All that the world trusted in, Babylon. You're going to see that Babylon is going to become the absolute, total, complete economic, political, military powerhouse in the world at that time. Nobody will have believed that it would ever fall. You're going to see some things that the Old Testament declares that the world's going to, you know, what city is like unto this city? It says that she sits as queen of the earth. So when that angel goes out and says Babylon is fallen, Who's going to believe that? Only those that keep the commandments of the Lord and follow Him. And then that third angel goes out and says, hey, you take the mark of the beast, you're going to die the second death. But you know what? There are those that are not going to take the mark of the beast. And blessed are they that die in the Lord from this point forward. And they're dying specifically because they're refusing the mark of the beast. One other quick interesting point. A lot of times in the Old Testament and several times in the New, in the tribulation epistles and so forth, you'll see a phrase, fatherless and widows. Fatherless and widows. How does somebody become fatherless? His father was executed. Yeah. What's that? He didn't take the mark. Exactly. Yeah. Isn't that fascinating? You know? So, anyway, we'll pick up here next time. We're out of time. We're going to pick up in chapter 14, verse 14 next time. You read that. The time of the great harvest is there. Okay? Chapter 14, verse 14. Okay, we'll be dismissed now.